This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm going to give you kind of a broad overview about, from my perspective, measurement and some of the important healthy benefits of vitamin D. And I already told you what my conflict of interests were, but not really for this presentation. So I thought I'd bring you initially a case. And that is, here's a 7-month-old female, muscle weakness, seizures. Her calcium is half normal and got a lot of publicity in Boston because it turns out it's the first old land gorilla born in captivity to mom at the Franklin Zoo and about to die. Talking about measurement, they actually had a pediatrician come in, evaluated the infant, decided that maybe it had rickets, so gave 400 units, and it didn't do any good. And so concluded the infant had some rare genetic disorder and wished the caretaker good luck. Well, the infant's complaining to mom. Dad's upset. He knows his daughter's in deep trouble. Have you ever wondered what he was really trying to say? That's what he was trying to say. So indeed, that's what they did. They got to call me, and I got to see the infant. And infant has classic wide epiphyseal plates. So talk about a measurement. Here's a classic skeletal measurement for rickets. And how do you treat aggressively? So I gave this infant 5,000 units of vitamin D a day, and the infant's feeling great. In fact, I was the guest of honor for her first birthday. But what's the message here? Mommy, will my growth be stunted? If you go to the zoo and saw her for the first couple of years of her life, her growth was stunted because of in utero and her first few weeks of life of vitamin D deficiency. And you'll be hearing a lot more about this from Carol Wagner in a little bit. But we estimate probably 50% of infants born in the United States today are still being born in a deficient or insufficient state. 1889 in Boston, rickets was common, right? Is it a problem today? You better believe it. Indeed, we see on average a dozen cases a year at our hospital. And again, talking about measurement, I mean, you don't need a 20-hydroxy-D to tell you that infant is vitamin D deficient. And indeed, the problem is this, that you're going to be hearing about more from Carol, that yes, docs have been telling patients to give your infant human breast milk as a sole source of nutrition. As you've heard, there's essentially no vitamin D in human breast milk unless you give them an adequate amount of vitamin D that you heard from Dr. Hollis yesterday and you'll be hearing from Dr. Wagner today. And so we did a study. I went to our neonatologist. I said, I'll bet you that your pregnant women are vitamin D deficient. And her response was instantaneous. Get out of my office, Hollick. We take care of our patients. They take their prenatal vitamin. And in fact, they're taking also 2 glasses of milk a day. And sure enough, when we looked at 40 mother-infant pairs, 70% taking a multivitamin, 2 glasses of milk a day, 600 units a day. This is what is recommended by the Institute of Medicine for all adults up to the age of 70, including pregnant women. And we had published this before they met, and we showed 76% of moms, 81% of newborns were vitamin D deficient at the time they gave birth. But they considered it a small study, even though it was a prospective study. Also, we went out to show what Lisa Bodner, preeclampsia, as you've heard a little while ago, is associated with vitamin D deficiency. Now, who are they? These are 3 children born by cesarean section. You heard yesterday about the flat pelvis of women who are vitamin D deficient in utero in their first few years of life. C-section became popular because of rickets, because women could not have normal childbirthing. So they were born by C-section by Murda Cameron in 1889. But you can see how severely growth retardation that they have because they still were vitamin D deficient in Glasgow, Scotland. And so we did a study because we also know vitamin D is critically important for muscle function, which of course is important for the birthing action. And when we looked at over 200 women at our hospital giving birth, we realized that if they were simply vitamin D sufficient, 400% reduced risk of requiring a C-section. So what we usually recommend to pregnant women, 2,000 units of vitamin D a day on top of their prenatal vitamin, on top of vitamin D coming from other dietary sources, so that they're getting around 3,000 to 4,000 units a day, just like Dr. Hollis and Dr. Wagner have shown very nicely. Now, this is Cliff Rosen, and I think you've heard his name many times. He's actually a close personal friend, and he was on the IOM committee, and he asked me to participate in that NIH conference. And he wanted to know, what process did the Endocrine Society use to make its recommendations, which you heard yesterday were a lot different than what the IOM recommended? And so I chaired that committee. I was fortunate enough to be asked to chair it. And every one of these members are experts in the field of vitamin D. And it turns out that the objective was clear: to evaluate, treat, and prevent vitamin D deficiency, with emphasis on care of patients who are at risk. The Institute of Medicine came out, of course, in 2010, and all of these members are certainly well known in the nutrition field and in bone metabolism, but they don't really have a focused expertise in the field of vitamin D. And the IOM was not intended to direct physician for patient care. It was up to professional associations to make these guidelines, and they used a population model, not a medical model, for their recommendations. So it's not a surprise that we would have different recommendations. The IOM had realized that the RDA from the adequate intake should be 3 times what was originally thought. So they now recommended for most children and adults not 200 a day, but 600 units a day. And they also recognized vitamin D is not as toxic, recommending up to 4,000 units a day for older children and adults. But did they get it right? That's the question. And so IOM says that you could get it from your diet. But this is the problem. It's rare in foods, as you heard about yesterday, right? Yes, there's 100 units in some dairy products, as well as in fortified orange juice. But basically, no one in the United States can get even the IOM recommendation from dietary sources. You'd have to drink 6 glasses of milk a day in order to be successful. And when we did a study from the National Health Survey back in 2002, we showed that for children and adults, no matter where they were in the United States, that they could not get enough vitamin D from their diet to satisfy the new IOM recommendations. So you can't get it from your diet. So IOM, sunlight plays a little role in vitamin D status. Well, sunlight is the major source. I think everybody agrees. In fact, here in Denmark even, no matter what your ethnicity, the peak blood levels are at the end of the summer. The nadir is always at the end of the winter. So we did a study, and you've heard about this over and over again, where we took healthy adults and put them in our tanning bed and gave them an oral dose of vitamin D separately to ask the question, if you get one minimal erythemal dose in a bathing suit, how does that relate to how much oral vitamin D you're taking? And this was the data. So here's a 10,000-unit dose. Here's a 25,000-unit dose. Now, what you could see very nicely, as Dr. Heaney pointed out, is that when you take vitamin D orally, it rapidly goes up and comes right back down. But when you're making it in your skin, it slowly increases because pre-D is converting to D, and then the D is slowly exiting the epidermis of bloodless tissue into the circulation. So you're maintaining your blood levels of vitamin D for a prolonged period of time. And that's why we can conclude that the area under the curve is, in fact, equivalent to about 20,000 units of vitamin D, and you're being able to maintain your vitamin D level much better than taking it as a supplement, at least twofold. So one exposure equivalent to about 10 to 20,000 units of vitamin D. And we showed over and over again, if you give a half an MED 3 times a week to young and middle-aged Caucasian volunteers, 155% increase that then begins to plateau after about 4 to 6 weeks. Also, Bernsey here, right, being older, right, and we know aging markedly decreases your capacity, but we took some elders. Their blood level on average 28 because they were taking a multivitamin, and when we put them in our tanning bed, a half an MED 3 times a week, we could show very nicely a 98% increase, plateaued at around 55 nanograms per ml. Right, we also looked at both type 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and we could show very nicely type 2, up at 60 nanograms per ml we could achieve. 1,000 units a day is what you would get here, that you would raise it from about 15 to 18 to about 28 nanograms per ml. And so one half MED, 3 times a week in elderly Caucasians, increased by 98%. Now, people keep asking, so when do you want to measure 25-hydroxy-D? Because people just say, just measure it. Well, what if you measure in the summer or in the winter? Is it going to make any difference? And Quest Diagnostics, which is one of the major reference labs in the United States, and I've consulted for them for over 35 years, helped them develop both the 125-D and 25-hydroxy-D assay, but I have no conflict because I don't benefit from them. doing those assays, we looked at 3.3 million sample data. And what did we find? What we found was that you could have about 3.3 million samples, typically in the United States, right, is that men and women, and you could see here that males are a little bit lower than females, is that 19 on average in the wintertime, 27 is the peak in the summertime. But look at this, PTH in the north, much bigger variation, again, because in the south you're making vitamin D for a longer period of time than you are in the north compared to the south. Also, 25-hydroxy-D peaks at the summertime, here over a three-year period of time. PTH levels peak in the wintertime. There's almost a mirror image. And in fact, if you want to look at the PTH levels when they're at their nadir, it's about 4 weeks later than when the 25-hydroxy vitamin D is up. So if you're going to get a 25-hydroxy vitamin D, you really want to get it at its nadir, because if it is 30 in the summertime, you're likely to be at around 21 or 25 in the wintertime. So this is one of the questions that nobody seems to ever ask. Probably our hunter-gatherer forefathers every day making vitamin D constantly probably maintained a steady level of PTH. But we now know in the United States that essentially everyone has this fluctuation in PTH levels, and no one knows what the potential impact is. We know that PTH actually has effects on your immune system, and it has, of course, effects on calcium and bone metabolism, as well as a whole variety of other physiologic processes. Tanning. 10 million tanners in the United States. It's estimated about 1 million tan in the United States every day. So we asked the question, tanners in Boston, what are their blood levels in the wintertime? And we know from the National Health Survey data that whether you're white, Caucasian, or white, or Mexican-American, or black, you have higher bone density for a higher 25-hydroxy-D. So we wondered, would tanners have higher levels of 25-hydroxy-D and have higher bone density? So we did an analysis of their bone density, and look at this. Non-tanners, in this wintertime, just about right, about 18 nanograms per ml. Tanners, usually going to a tanning bed maybe once a week, average 48 nanograms per ml. When we looked at their bone density, we showed very nicely that they had a statistically significant increase in their femoral neck bone density just based on their higher blood level of 25-hydroxy vitamin D. So how do you know your vitamin D status? Well, we know, of course, you want to measure 25-hydroxy-D, and you never want to order the active form because it tells you nothing about vitamin D status. It's normal or elevated in a vitamin D deficient state. Why? It circulates at 1,000 times less concentration. As you heard from Dr. Heaney, the half-life is very short, only 2 to 4 hours. And also, PTH, as it's going up, it's telling the kidneys to activate more vitamin D. But the Institute of Medicine, what they cared about was this study, which is 675 German adults that died in an accident. They got their bones and their blood, and they looked at the biopsies. And sure enough, here's normal trabecular bone. Here you see hardly any black areas. This is low bone density, poor connectivity, osteoporosis. And you see this pink stuff here? This is classic unmineralized osteoid, classic for vitamin D deficiency. So even though reasonable amount of trabeculae, it's mainly vitamin D deficient. So the Institute of Medicine said, well, maybe we could relate 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels to the degree of osteomalacia and give us an estimate of how important 25-hydroxy D is regarding bone health. The authors had said up to 25%, up to 36% had some evidence of vitamin D deficiency. These are otherwise healthy adult Germans, ages 20 to 90 years of age. So the authors concluded, to guarantee sufficiency, you need to be above 30. But the Institute of Medicine says, no. We looked at your data much more carefully, and we concluded that you didn't have to worry about this if you were above 20. And this is what they said. They took this group here between 21 and 29 over this group here, and they concluded it's less than 1%. So therefore, you don't need to be above 20. But they made a seventh grade high school error, right? Mathematical error. They should have taken this group here over this group here. If you do that, 24% of otherwise healthy adult Germans had evidence of vitamin D deficiency bone disease, and that's what they should have concluded. And that's why the authors suggested and the Endocrine Society recommended, at a minimum for bone health, you should be greater than 30 nanograms per ml. PTH levels, we talked about briefly, right? There's a lot of scatter. So people said, well, if there's so much scatter, how can you really make any sense out of this? But studies have shown that PTH levels really begin to plateau at around 30 nanograms per ml. We did a study throughout the entire United States in postmenopausal women, and these are within standard error of the mean levels, right? So these are very tight levels of 1,500 women. Again, around 30 nanograms per ml plateaus. And we went on to show if you're at 21, you have a 3 times higher risk of having secondary hyperparathyroidism than if you're above 30. So all of this information that was gathered, the Endocrine Practice Guidelines Committee recommended at a minimum for bone health, your blood level should be above 30 nanograms per ml. But because of the variability in the assays that are out there, to guarantee sufficiency, we thought a good range was minimum 40, up to 60 is really quite reasonable, but 100 is certainly perfectly safe. Indeed, that's, you've heard this over and over again, is that Maasai warriors, and we've done a study now in African children, found exactly the same thing. On average, their levels are about 40 to 50 nanograms per ml. Is vitamin D deficiency a health issue? You've already heard this very nicely from Dr. Gorman, right? But here is a study that I worked with Clifford Rosen up in Bangor, Maine. Young white girls taking a Flintstone vitamin, 2 glasses of milk a day, 600 units a day. 48% were vitamin D deficient, right? Here, Catherine Gordon showed in Boston, 42% of teenagers vitamin D deficient. And even the CDC says 32% of all children and adults vitamin D deficient, right? They even published their data showing very nicely at every age group that vitamin D deficiency was common. Indeed, if you pick 30 as the cutoff from the National Health Survey, 50% of our children are vitamin D deficient, 1 to 5 years of age, 70% 6 to 11 years of age. Globally, we now recognize basically 40% of the population is deficient and 60% is insufficient. Whether you're in Australia or Canada or Korea, basically you see the same thing. And it's all because you basically can't get vitamin D from significant amounts from your diet. And as a result, everybody has vitamin D deficiency. How do you treat and prevent it? Well, what we do is when you treat vitamin D deficiency is 50,000 units of D2 or D3. We can talk about this during our break in terms of D2 issues. 8 weeks, so that's basically 6,500 units of vitamin D a day. And then to prevent recurrence, I put them on 50,000 units every 2 weeks. And I do it for a couple of reasons. One is patients that come to me want a prescription. They're more likely to follow the doctor's advice rather than telling them to go and buy a supplement. They may remember that for a couple of months, but they're not going to remember that year after year. So I agree with Bruce that it's probably better to be taking it on a daily basis, but it's certainly better to at least have something rather than nothing. And that's why most of my patients are on this program, about 3,000 units a day. We'll talk a little bit about toxicity in a minute, but here, Einstein, just like everyone else, thinks vitamin D is toxic, and maybe it's going to build up in your body fat over time. So, yeah, maybe a couple of weeks or months or even a year, you're not going to see toxicity. But what about year after year? So we published a paper in Archives of Internal Medicine in 2009. After 6 years on 3,000 units a day, the blood levels plateau and are maintained at around 40 to 60 nanograms per ml. Also, recommendation for children is a 600 to 1,000 units. For adults, Endocrine Society said 1,500 to 2,000. If you ever wonder what he was trying to say. That's a real problem, right? And so here, Barney's even amazed to hear this, right? And reason is that vitamin D is fat soluble and it gets incorporated in your body fat. And as a result, the higher your BMI, lower is your vitamin D status. And we and others have shown very nicely that there's lots of vitamin D in your fat. If you take obese people, give them an oral dose or put them in a tanning bed compared to an obese person, normal weight versus an obese person, about a 55% reduction just in the blood level of vitamin D. And this study out of Pure North shows very nicely, if you look at, say, the 40 nanogram cutoff for underweight, overweight, and obese, that here, 2,000 units a day will get to 40 if you're normal weight. You need at least 6,000 if you're obese. And so the conclusion of this study of over several thousand people, 2.5 to 3 times more vitamin D if you have a BMI of greater than 30 to satisfy your vitamin D requirement. And it's no question that it's there. We and others have shown very nicely that vitamin D is certainly in your body fat. So obese people need 2 to 3 times more. Now, I'm not sure what he's thinking about here, but I tell you what. Do you know why vitamin D is so regulated and so considered to be so toxic? You had heard already from John Cannell yesterday that, yes, patients with rheumatoid arthritis were treated with hundreds of thousands of units of vitamin D. They became toxic. And because now this huge amount was in the body fat and being released, they remained toxic for years. But it was this observation that really got everybody's attention. Before 1950, even in England, custard was fortified with vitamin D. And in Chicago, hot dogs fortified with vitamin D. Everything in the world was being fortified with vitamin D because it was thought to be kind of this miracle nutrient. And then in the 1950s, all of a sudden there appeared infants with high blood calcium, altered faces, mental retardation, heart problems. And so now there was hysteria. And so now the experts wanted to find out what was the reason. So the legislative body brought in the experts, and they looked at the literature. They had not a clue what this could be. And so they decided that if you give pregnant rats intoxicating doses of vitamin D, guess what? They have high blood calcium in their pups, funny altered faces, heart problems. They couldn't figure out if they were mentally retarded. And it turns out that the experts concluded that the outbreak was due to overfortification of milk with vitamin D. They had no evidence for this, but they assumed this based on that rodent data. So you're banned all vitamin D fortification in dairy and all products. In England, you cannot put vitamin D in a skin cream. It is against the law still today. It's likely, though, that what they had was Williams syndrome. It's a rare genetic disorder. Curiously, they have elfin facies. And they have heart problems, they have mild retardation, and guess what? They have a hypersensitivity to vitamin D, causing hypercalcemia. We know that this is the likely cause, but no one in Europe is still taking this seriously and thinking about changing the health recommendations in most of European countries. So vitamin D fortification continues to be a major issue in many countries around the world. So what about detoxification? It turns out, like you've heard before, up to 10,000 units is perfectly safe. And many have shown this. But this study coming out of Pure North, I think, says it very nicely. And that is, here, 15,000 units a day, 20,000 units a day. If you think 24-hydroxy-D levels on average of about 60, right, with the upper limit certainly being 100, you need to take huge amounts of vitamin D to get above 100. So that conversation that we had yesterday about being 100 to 200 is really very difficult to get there. And these data really show very nicely what happens when you increase your vitamin D intake and that no way will you become toxic. But this is the other issue, right? You've heard about the mortality issue and the very nice study from Cedric, right? And here a study out of Germany showed, again, 25% reduction in all-cause mortality with the higher blood levels of 25-hydroxy-D. And you already saw this from Cedric Garland's work. But the IOM said, wait a second. We agree, if you're vitamin D deficient, that you are at increased risk for mortality. But there's this J curve. When you get around 30 nanograms per ml, we say that you now have an increased risk. Well, we went back and looked at some of this data, and this is one of the papers that they actually quoted as part of that data set. And guess what? The authors suggested actually lower risk for mortality up to 49 nanograms per ml, and only greater in 50 nanograms per ml for mortality in women, right? That's a lot different than what the IOM concluded. But this is really what you need to ask. Who is having a blood level 3-4 years ago of greater than 50? There has to be a reason, right? They're not simply all of a sudden having a light turned on saying they're taking lots of vitamin D and they're now capturing this group. Most likely they're being treated for vitamin D deficiency and maybe taking mega doses of other stuff. How can you figure that out? Turns out, go back to that 3.3 million samples from Quest, because we could show very nicely that if you can detect vitamin D2 in the circulation, it's likely coming from being treated for vitamin D deficiency. And sure enough, 59% of the total 25-hydroxy-D levels greater than 50 had detectable levels of 25-hydroxy-D2, suggesting that this so-called J-curve may actually be due to the fact that they were D-deficient in the first place. So those with a 25-hydroxy-D of greater than 50 most had detectable levels, thus being treated for vitamin D deficiency. IOM, bottom line, they're recommending 400 units for infants, 600 units for children, and 600 units for adults until you're 70, and then they give you a little boost of 800, right? Now, this paper just came out, again, from the Pure North group, and they said, hey, guys at the AOM, if you're saying that this is an RDA, that means it has to be 97.5% upper limit and lower limit. And they said that this is where you really need to be to get 30 nanograms per ml by the IOM at 2,000 units a day. But the Pure North group said, no, no, no. If you actually take the 97.5% confidence limit, you have a group down here, you would need 6,000 to 8,000 units a day to be able to reach that level, which is now we all recognize is right on target. Bottom line, there's no downside to increasing your vitamin D intake. And we don't need to be a genius to know this, right? Indeed, this is not a hypothesis. The issue is going to be this, though, because it's extremely expensive and time-consuming to get a blood level drawn. And so both the Institute of Medicine and the Endocrine Society and most other societies don't recommend screening. Simply increase your vitamin D intake. It's a much more effective and cheaper way. But if you're obese, malabsorption, if you have sarcoid, no question you should be followed. Recommendation from the Endocrine Society, 400 to 1,000 for neonates, 600 to 1,000 for children. Teenagers probably need at least 1,500 to 2,000 like adults, and certainly we recommend it for adults at least 1,500 to 2,000, and recognize that if you're obese, 2 to 3 times more. And upper limit, easily, for neonates, 2,000 units a day based on opponents' data. Basically, 1 to 18 years of age, easily 4,000, and for adults, easily 10,000 units a day. And if you're over 70, same thing. Long story short, we showed 1,000 units a day to healthy students at our medical school. Not one person basically was sufficient. 1,000 units a day will not make you sufficient. Indeed, I typically recommend it's just easy for adults to take 2,000 units a day, and I tell my friends that get their children to take 1,000 units a day. Vitamin D is really good for your health. And thank you for your kind attention.
Carol Baggerly asked me to do another short presentation on measurement after she had put me on the website. In a way, she made me an offer I could not refuse, I guess. So this time, I think it's essential to look again at the disclosures, since two of these companies are manufacturers of tanning beds. And some of the measurements I did are only able with funding from the industry, because taking the vitamin D levels of 80 subjects 6 times costs quite a lot of money. So, but this is the only way to learn about the particular properties of these units and to, in order to improve them. So, why is it important to measure? There are a lot of words around, for example, full spectrum. Have you ever stumbled across the full spectrum lamps? Who has full spectrum lamps in use? In the office, for example. So, some of you. For that reason, I want to start with an example which focuses on sunlight, on the spectral measurement of sunlight. Here we have a spectral distribution which is kind of typical for direct sunlight. We see the color temperature. The CCT stands for correlated color temperature, which means we have glowing bodies which give off a kind of thermal spectrum, light from heat, and this is the case in the sun. So with sunlight, we have the correlated color temperature of 5,200 or 5,500 Kelvin equals the real physical temperature of this glowing body. And by the way, the color rendering index of sunlight is 99. It's an index, it's not percent, but it's a value of 99 from 100. So yesterday we saw this spectral distribution curve of sunlight, and when we put these two curves together, we find it's somehow identical, or it's at least similar. And just to give you an idea what is possible today in terms of spectrum analysis or measuring the quality of sunlight, I want to show you this slide. And do you have any idea what this slide could represent? It's a very high resolution spectral analysis of sunlight. And who has an idea what these... So these are 50 lines. You have to put them all together to get the full spectrum in the visible part of electromagnetic radiation, which is given off from our sun. And who has an idea? These black lines we find dissecting the this spectrum. There are some frequencies or some wavelengths absent. So these black lines, they are called Fraunhofer lines, according to the optician, the famous German optician Josef von Fraunhofer. And when I said yesterday that we will never be able to mimic or to produce sunlight in its real quality in an artificial manner, then these Fraunhofer lines are kind of explanation for this claim, because this is really, it's like a barcode. It's very complicated and it carries a very specific information. And what we can even tell from astronomical or astrophysical or solar physics measurements, that these Fraunhofer lines, they shift in the spectrum with the breathing rhythm of the sun. This is about 5 minutes. And within these 5 minutes, these Fraunhofer lines move in their position, in their relative position. So this information can never be produced artificially. Just one suggestion. When you think about what Dr. Hollick told us yesterday, that sunlight was known in the 1920s and 30s to cure more than 165 different diseases. And we had kind of hyperactivities and hypoactivities. And what these doctors from 80 years ago had to learn, that sunlight balances the situation in the body. And when I think about the tenth of a millimeter, and I think about the bloodstream under the surface of the skin, which is reached by this kind of radiation, And by the way, we have to explain another thing. These Fraunhofer lines, they come from all the elements which are in the outmost layer in the sun, in the solar atmosphere. So in a way, we have all these chemical elements in our body, in our bloodstream, and sunlight produces a kind of photonic pressure in these zones where we have color here, and in the zones where we have the black lines, there is nothing, no pressure, no photonic pressure. Maybe sunlight is even able to regulate the distribution, extracellular, intracellular distribution of chemical elements. It's an hypothesis. It's not proven, but when you look at this, you might get a better understanding about the special constitution of sunlight, and we can tell this today and maybe explain things our ancestors discovered in a phenomenological way. Coming back to this more simple measurement, this is sunlight measured directly without anything in between. This is sunlight behind modern window panes. In order to, do you see any difference between this and that? Here in the near in the red and in the near infrared part of the spectrum, we have some filtering which comes from the window technology, because when the architects don't use this kind of window technology, the building will heat up much more, so they need more energy for cooling purposes. So everything in the lighting industry and daylight technology seems to be driven by energy efficiency ideas. And now I will come to this particular spectrum. This is a so-called full spectrum fluorescent lamp spectrum. We can see a kind of similar correlated color temperature, but it comes from a cold light source. And you can say, you can see in the spectral distribution that this really does not deserve the name full spectrum. It's too much disrupted, and there are wavelengths missing, especially in the longer wavelength range, where we already talked about the benefits of near-infrared yesterday. This near-infrared is lacking completely, more or less completely, in fluorescent lamps. And it's just a quantitative difference between a standard compact fluorescent lamp and this so-called full-spectrum fluorescent lamp. But what they would tell you, it is a sun-like spectrum. Why? Because the correlated color temperature is similar to the real temperature of our glowing star. And sometimes the logic is even if we have more, if we have a higher color temperature, then we are even better than the sun. But this, you might believe this as long as you do not measure the spectra we are talking about. And this, by the way, is a typical spectrum of a white fluorescent LED, light-emitting diode, which is featured at the moment and which can be found, for example, in our hotel. Who is staying at this, at the Estancia Hotel? Have you registered or realized that this that the lighting there is some LED lighting with high color temperatures? It's not very comfortable and cozy in the afternoon or in the evening. And this is the spectrum you find in this particular kind of technology. And I would dare to say this is not better than the sun. So what I wanted to show you in this section of my short presentation, when you start measuring, you go beyond the words. full spectrum. What a pretty word. But as long as you didn't measure, you will never understand what lies behind. Coming now to the measurement of blood levels of vitamin D. The measurements enable us to make research, for example, in order to improve the technology in artificial insulation or for producing artificial sunlight, artificial UV and probably fuller spectrum light. And for me as a physician, I see patients, and when I draw blood from a patient of mine, especially if it's a chronic patient, then I take the vitamin D levels in order to monitor how the patients react if I administer vitamin D orally. I really want to know, but I run a private practice, so I don't have to look at the financial aspects. And if you give recommendations to the public, we are talking about millions and millions of people, and in this context, it's not so easy to make measurements of the blood levels on a regular basis, for example, twice a year. But I think this is, for me as a physician, it's just part of being precise, that I control what the intervention will result in my individual cases. So here, this is a word I like very much. It's the civilizational anhelios. It's the lack of sunlight caused by civilization. And this is kind of optimal prophylaxis of the civilizational anhelios, but who is able to practice this kind of prevention? Would you please raise your hands? High noon, every day, because regular exposure is better than intermittent exposure. So who is able to practice it in a proper way? 5% in the audience, maybe. This might be a problem. We saw this slide yesterday, and what this chart explains is a lot about the technique of heliotherapy. And what you can see here, time measured in minutes is a crucial factor to perform proper heliotherapy in the right way. Because this patient needs a blanket, and this blanket has to be moved from the feet up to the upper parts of the body. In a timeline of 5 minutes, every 5 minutes you have to shift or pull up the blanket a little bit more. So for proper heliotherapy, the most important measurement under the sun is to measure the time. And we heard that avoiding a sunburn, avoiding overdosage is essential. And when we look at different effects of sunlight, it acts upon the body, but it as well acts upon mind and soul. So the mind starts wandering, you feel cozy, you feel comfortable, you start kind of dreaming, you go into a theta rhythm in your brain. And suddenly you go into the delta rhythm of your brain. What does this mean? You fall asleep. So many of the sunburn cases come from falling asleep in the sun. So don't fall asleep. A smartphone is not resistant to sunlight. It will heat up. I experienced myself that my smartphone switched off before it could alert me that the time is over. thankfully, I have an inner clock I can rely upon, as long as I didn't travel to the US in the 6 weeks before. But now it's not a problem because we have winter in Germany. No risk. My circadian rhythms, at least, are not travel-proof. So I come to the last part of my measurement presentation, talking about technologies which automatically provide the right dose and stop when the time is over. Here is a publication, a paper on the effect of small subarythmal doses in a medical ultraviolet cabinet. But medical cabinets are not limited in output, so it's clear that they can help to build up vitamin D. But they are not available to the public, not freely available. These are not over-the-counter units. So here is a paper published in 2012. So this was before we had the regulation in the European Union, which limits the fluence, the energy density, the energy output of the tanning beds to 0.3 watts per square meter. So the question has to be raised, do these limitations in output performance have a negative impact on the potential to build up vitamin D? Here we see this paper which has been examining a commercial tanning bed which was not restricted in output that much than we compared to those we have to use today. We have an energy density of 375 to 525 joule per square meter, and this was a single exposure, and the mean increase was about 1.8 nanograms per milliliter, which is not much, but you at least can prevent the vitamin D level from decreasing. And here I would like to present some numbers from a trial I performed last year. The data you saw from Dr. Hollick before may be difficult to achieve nowadays because, as I said, nowadays we have different conditions. We have much lower output of the units. But what we can see here, in the interventional group, the vitamin D level rose from about 16 nanograms per milliliter to nearly 26 after 16 treatments. Here you see the changes in percent compared to baseline. And here we asked our subjects, do they tan regularly, sometimes, only rarely, or never? And what you can tell from this chart is that the never tanners, they had a value around 12.5 nanograms per milliliter and nearly double the amount was found in the regular tanning group. So we applied a total dose which lay in between the 375 and 525. We applied, independent from the skin type, here for four treatments, 460 joule per square meter. And to make, I learned from you, Paul, from your presentation yesterday, I just changed the logic of sorting these data. You can say that those with the lowest levels at baseline, these are the blue blocks, they had the highest benefit in terms of increase in vitamin D. This was after four treatments with around 100 joule per square meter each. But what is interesting to me, when we look at those with a higher level, then we find significant decreases from baseline to the values after 4 treatments. And I asked Dr. Hollick this morning if he has any explanation, and you hadn't. I have not. But this slide with these examples is good for highlighting again how important measurement in fact is, because there are cases in which we are unable to predict the individual reaction. So it's very important to monitor what you do. The next study, by the way, I have planned measures of the effect of treatments with so-called hybrid tanning beds. It's one step closer to a kind of full-spectrum artificial tanning. We reduce the dose of ultraviolet radiation by a factor of 2 again, but we add long-wave radiation in the orange-red part of the spectrum. And we know from the reports from users that it's much better, it's much more comfortable and smoother and easier for the skin, and at least the tanning performance is comparable to the standard UV beds. And now we will apply our idea, our principle of measurement again in order to find out if there is also an effect on the vitamin D production if we treat not only with the short wavelengths but with the longer wavelengths as well. So here is an internet address where you can find, I think, 4 or 5 audiovisual presentations of mine, which are in English. So if you are interested to go into other topics, maybe you can visit this page and have a look for free. So thank you very much for your kind attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.